From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Kelly Starrett's book has a title that draws you in, Becoming a Supple Leopard. Starrett is a physical therapist who studies the way humans move, or should move, because many of us, maybe most of us, are doing it wrong. The leopard reference came from a moment of revelation he had years ago. Leopards, those fast and nimble cats, he realized, don't have to work at being supple, they just are. And humans should be too, he says. We're designed to move. Yet Starrett says humans are notoriously tight. Our range of motion is kind of pitiful, and it has all kinds of effects on our mental and physical health. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on health and fitness. Starrett will join us to explain how to move your body after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So by now, a lot of you have heard about the dangers of sitting. And all over the country, people are getting standing desks and treadmills and movement apps. Kelly Starrett says that's a good thing. Moving is a good thing. It's natural. Evolution has embedded movement deep into our genes. We're designed to move, but we don't always get it right. Our form, when we run, when we jump, even when we're going somewhere or lifting something, is often just wrong. Starrett is a physical therapist who studies movement, and he teaches it. He understands the physiology behind it, the history of it, and today in the program he's joining us as we continue our series on health and fitness. We're hoping to hear from you today with comments, but probably questions mostly about learning how to develop a physical system or a practice or a routine for moving. Join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Kelly Starrett's book is Becoming a Supple Leopard, the Ultimate Guide to Resolving Pain, Preventing Injury, and Optimizing Physical Performance. He's a coach, he's a physical therapist, an author, a speaker, co-founder of San Francisco CrossFit and the Mobility WOD blog. And he's joining us today from a studio in Sausalito, California. And Kelly Starrett, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I should also mention he has a new book coming out in the spring called Desk Bound, Sitting is the New Smoking. We'll talk about that as we go along. So I want to start, though, with I heard you say once that you had been obsessed with human movement ever since you were fairly young. And you mentioned this story when you were 12 years old. You went to ski camp and you really lit up when someone started diagramming a turn, I think it was.
I was at a ski camp in Austria as a child, and the reigning World Cup champion was sort of diagramming where the pressure should be and the technical positions of the hip. And I remember even at that age, I'm thinking, wow, you know, like this, if I could figure out how to talk about this and live in this moment, this sort of thing, I mean, just lit up as a kid. And, you know, probably, you know, there are some pre-sparks we can recognize, some nascent, you know, interests that if we could connect the dots backwards, you know, most of us, music or art or performance or science. But that was, I remember, just a seminal moment for me when thinking, well, you know, boy, I really like this. And then lo and behold, it turned out that really was the genesis for a lifetime of being obsessed with, you know, going faster and being pain-free, and it ultimately led me to here.
I wonder, did it start internally in the sense that I'm interested in movement and these kinds of things because I want to be fit personally? And then does it evolve and extend out to, okay, I've kind of figured it out or I'm figuring it out and I want to teach other people? I mean, is that sort of the natural evolution, was it, for you?
Well, I think, you know, I can use a metaphor. Sometimes I say to young physical therapists when I lecture at my school, you know, why do you want to be a physio? And they say, well, I really like helping people. And I was like, well, that's really sounds great on the surface, but why do you want to do this? And ultimately they were like, well, I really like the work. And I mean, that's the truth. And I think this intrinsic, you know, satisfaction that I had in figuring this out and sort of reconciling this really technical aspect of skiing with, you know, actually going faster in performance, that was, you know, that gave me innate pleasure. And then it's interesting because there were so many educators in my family. And, you know, my mom's a professor, and I sat through so many psychology lectures as a young child. And I think I got my first teaching job at age 14, that those sort of interests started to really coalesce into this, boy, I was intrinsically motivated, and yet I was developing this sort of skill set as a teacher. And, it, you know, those things sort of, you know, connected and built upon themselves as I taught in college and kept teaching kind of complex motor skills. What was really interesting was, you know, as soon as you step into academia, you know, we're so divorced sometimes from the practical applications of what it is we're doing. And it's you have to live in both worlds. My mom laughed, of course, when I said, hey, I'm going to grad school. And she's like, I told you you would, you know. And
right.
and I was like, but I'll never do research. I'm a clinician. And of course, here we are now. And she's like, are you ready to do research? And I was like, yes, I understand, you know.
Yeah. There's another story I want you to tell early on. Because it gets to the title of your book, Becoming a Supple Leopard. You'd mentioned that you've been fascinated when you were younger with leopards as kind of these models for speed and strength. And when you were 14 years old, you tell the story in the book about that you had seen the Australian film Gallipoli with your dad, and there was the reference to the leopard.
Completely appropriate, you know, teenage fodder of, right? You know, just like, let's wreck your children early. But that notion, you know, where his mantra is, you know, his uncle is saying, how fast are you going to run? Like, fast as a leopard. And that really kind of became even a family joke a little bit of when I was competing later on. And then one day I ran into a friend who was a Navy SEAL who'd been injured in Iraq, you know, had been shot and, you know, was rehabilitating himself. And he's like, you know, Kelly, you know, the leopard never stretches. And originally I kind of resisted that. And I was like, you know, look, Andy, you know, you're not a leopard. Like, that's a type one error right off the bat.
Yeah.
But it really kind of got to the heart and soul of that. Why don't we have this sort of full physical capacity instantaneously? And here's a metaphor that people can relate to. When you see kids at kindergarten recess, they book for the monkey bars.
Yeah.
They book for the playground, and you don't see them doing a dynamic warm-up or doing steady-state cardio for 15 minutes or raising their core temperature. They sort of instantaneously are full-fledged humans being able to express that at a moment's notice, 0 to 60. And if you ask the average adult to do that, I mean, it would just end in flames.
So I want to make this point early on. When we're talking about movement, you're not talking about peak athletes, endurance athletes. That's got to be an important point, I think, for you, that this is pretty much for everyone. These are important points for everybody.
Well, we can really hit this from sort of multiple angles. We use, and it's been really fun to, you know, go behind the scenes everywhere. Imagine every tier one military asset, every major sports event, sports team, league. I got to go to behind the scenes of national teams, of Olympic teams, of universities. We get everyone's sort of dirty laundry. And what's really fun about that is I use the metaphor of saying, hey, this is my Formula One concept. Because if my thinking is correct, remember I'm also a physio, and I have to be able to scale it from injury and from elderly and children all the way up in my thinking to this elite performance. And so much of the elite performance has really dictated our thinking backwards. The analogy is, you know, a lot of the advances in car technology has come from Formula One. And so if I can use Formula One concepts, then I can trickle backwards and apply best practices to us all. And you're absolutely right. You know, it's really fun to help people set world records and go faster and go to the Olympics. But what's really amazing and empowering about our work is being able to show people that they can take charge using the same models of improving performance to resolving so many of the common scourges that face us. Everyday pain, low back pain, dysfunction, achiness. And the more that we can help people understand that this is just a continuum, that if I train and try to move correctly and then develop a movement practice around that, because the physiology is really known to us, and I sort of start to take care of my tissues, then what ends up happening is that I get injury prevention in the bargain, and I also get pain resolution in the bargain. And what we need to do is sort of stop focusing just on pain as the only metric to know whether or not we're in a good position or thriving as people. One of the issues for us is that we have this extraordinary set of hardware. The human being in this 2.5 million years of evolution is a really, really robust mechanical system. I mean, there's a story of a young guy who was a soldier and he got shot and he literally removed most of his left lung, and he had a little bit, like 2/3 of his lung left on the right side, and he climbed Everest on that. I mean, if you look at a horse, it gets a cold, we usually put the horse down. And humans are so well designed to be able to withstand and sort of manage maladaptation and just to be able to survive that we've sort of confused that robustness with the fact that we must be doing it right. And so suddenly we end up with this pain mechanism, or pain usually is the way that we start to get it, gets our attention. It doesn't just spontaneously resolve. And then we try to back engineer what's going on, and it turns out it's a lifetime of, you know, being on your texting device. You know, a new study just came out that said the average adult is spending 2.5 hours on their smartphone. And you know what position that is? That's in a little bent over U, shrimp back, neck broken, internally. I mean, it's a disastrous position. If you saw your daughter adopt that position, you would think she was crying, you know, and she's emotionally devastated. And yet those are the positions that we're starting to adopt as habitus. And so if we can give people a better set of software to run the hardware, then what we really start to see is that people thrive. And, you know, I was speaking with a physician friend yesterday, and you know, long ago, you know, if the human condition was set to, you know, only devolve and get worse, then we would have died a long time ago, horrible deaths. But the human is really set up to thrive with just a little input. It always wants to move towards sort of this homeostasis, you know, stasis where I'm pain-free, where, you know, I'm lucid, I don't have back pain, I don't feel stiff, you know, and it's remarkable what happens when we give a little care and feeding. And the problem is that hasn't been part of our language or vernacular or lexicon or training until recently.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You write about in your book that you have a sense that we moved better in our earlier history. I mean, you write about there's this the writing of this famous Japanese swordsman who wrote a book called The Book of Five Rings, where he really gets into detail about proper movement and proper stance. You mentioned seeing an ancient coin where someone was in this proper lotus position. So we were better at that even earlier in our history as human beings, I guess.
Well, I think it's easy to romanticize, you know, backwards and say, you know, we've always had it correct. And I it's interesting, you know, if you look at the Victorian era. Let's use an analogy. Maybe the listeners are familiar with the Macintosh chair. It's a very, very upright chair design. And, you know, I think this Victorian, very straight back, very, you know, I think that was part of our language and culture.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden in the 20s, it became very fashionable to slouch, for example. And the you know, modern furniture came about and made it possible with materials to slouch, and it was very kind of you know, in vogue to sort of in reaction to this very upright Victorian, you know, issue. So I think on one hand we see this certainly a cultural bias towards sort of the environment in which we're living. We do a lot more sitting now. And then I also think that not necessarily that we had figured it out earlier, but that people have been talking about improving the human condition for as long as there have been people. And if you look at some of these older traditions, you know, I come out of a very modern strength and conditioning tradition, but the yogis weren't messing around. And that, you know, for good 1,000 years, and certainly last 500 years, you know, they've been talking about the correct shoulder position and breathing mechanics. And I mean, all of those bits of like how to hack the human physiology. Joseph Pilates certainly wasn't wasting anyone's time trying to integrate gymnastics and ballet and movement. And I think that there have been serious thinkers for as long as there have been humans trying to improve how we feel. You know, I don't know if this is historically accurate or not, but in the book The Gates of Fire about, you know, about the Greeks, you know, there was a young boy assigned to every soldier to massage that soldier and rub liniments in there and, you know, open his joints. And, you know, I think the notion is that we have always been working towards it, but we haven't always connected the dots. And what's notable, is that humans are obsessed with being better and obsessed with technique and obsessed with ego and performance. And people have sort of figured out in every one of these movement traditions, the physiology ends up matching the technique. And so you'll see is that once you sort of understand backwards, well, we have this better picture of how the human is designed and how the physiology actually works. And suddenly you can go backwards and sort of deconstruct all of these other movement systems and understand what people were trying to do. And that's why we really believe now we're having this global conversation with coaches and in the internet and human performance and lifestyle pieces and nutrition, where if we don't solve it in this generation, we come up with an ethos or a blueprint plan, you know, we've really short-seated ourselves.
It's interesting. I mean, so we're in kind of a golden age in that way. I mean, at least that's your sense of it. For the first time, we're sharing this information across disciplines. There's this growing interest in the body. And as you said, then there's this access on the internet to all this information for people to share these kinds of things. So this is the perfect time to figure it out, I suppose.
And match that with really an innate sort of tide change that people are sort of, again, taking a little bit more personal responsibility for their food quality. And I live in Marin, and so, of course, you know, just north of San Francisco, I think there are three magazines about gluten-free living.
Right,
you know,
right.
But as long as popcorn now says it's gluten-free, something has changed in the greater culture. And I think as people are realizing, you know, that they're not feeling better, and I think that as people sort of are realizing, hey, I'm going to have to plan for my own retirement and manage my own health care, then what we've seen is sort of a global shift towards personal onus and loci of control. And I think it just happens to sort of, you know, correlate with this. And one of our hypotheses is, look, if you give people better information, a better set of tools, they'll make better decisions. I think for the longest time, we've really talked down to people and said, hey, you know, we've disenfranchised them and disempowered them to say you're probably not sophisticated to deal with your own knee pain, which is just, you know, ridiculous.
You said something compelling once, that the human body really, aside from a couple of little, you know, we have bigger feet these days and a couple of things that may be a little bit different, but we haven't really changed all that much in the last 10,000 years. How long do you figure, how our bodies, they're designed to last about how long?
Well, the research and the people in this field, you know, and a lot of this has really come out of some of the quantified self movement, which has really been great. People are, I mean, there's a lot of misplaced precision out there and people measuring all aspects of their lives. But people and some of the best thinkers are saying, hey, we should be able to be 110, no problem. And, you know, you don't stop producing growth hormone. You don't stop healing at any age. The system gets slower, right? And we sort of collect more errors. But the problem is, if you're designed to be 110 and you've worn a hole in your kneecap at age 25 or 35, or you've herniated a disc without some kind of catastrophic issue, you know, what is our plan to deal with the other 70 or 80 years? I mean, the goal is to not, you know, spend our genetics freely in our 20s and then say, well, I had to stop running and I don't really lift anymore. And, you know, I've worked in a lot of hospitals. And towards ends of life, people's lives get smaller and smaller and smaller. They, you know, they get into this room and then now the curtain's done and then you're in the ICU. And, you know, we take away options. And so much of that has been the same for people in their movement and how they're restricted. And, you know, pretty soon they're confined to a chair. And it's just probably because we're weak and we, you know, we don't sort of just keep the system moving. And as we sort of figure out a little bit more, you know, for a long time we said, hey, women, you know, and everyone, but specifically women, you're more, you know, susceptible to osteoporosis as your hormones change, as you age. You just need to walk. And it turned out, of course, that walking did nothing to increase bone density. They actually had to load like they were going to jump and land and hike and lift. And, you know, it's because, you know, it's not that we weren't working with our best sets of information. We just know more now. And as we know more, we can apply that. And it doesn't have to be, you know, I think the problem is it feels so daunting for so many people about starting. Where do I start? And what really is, you know, it doesn't matter where you start. You just have to start.
Kelly Starrett is with us, physical trainer, therapist, author of the book Becoming a Supple Leopard, The Ultimate Guide to Resolving Pain, Preventing Injury, and Optimizing Physical Performance. He has a new book coming out this spring called Desk Bound, Sitting is the New Smoking. Joining us from a studio in Sausalito, California, we invite you to join us with comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing our series on health and fitness with a focus on movement. You may have caught on to this new wave of thinking about high-intensity exercise and standing, but there's a chance you might not be moving correctly. So today in the program, we're continuing the series with physical therapist Kelly Starrett. He's on a crusade to fix poor technique and bad biomechanics and really just however you do it to start moving. His book is called Becoming a Supple Leopard, The Ultimate Guide to Resolving Pain, Preventing Injury, and Optimizing Athletic Performance. Our number to call, and we invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. What do you mean, Kelly Starrett, when you say we need to start making the invisible visible?
Well, you know, one of the issues is that how do we know what we're doing is correct? Yeah. So imagine you drove your car until it blew up. And then you were like, oh, I guess I should have put oil in it. And every time it blows up, I recognize that I'm out of oil. So I just wait till it blows up. And that's our entire model pretty much for how our body works. And so our model is, you know, we have to have a better way to sort of find problems before they blow up in our faces. And that is what we mean by making the invisible visible. And it turns out, you know, many of us play sports or try to be active, but it's really difficult to see those restrictions, to see the movement errors if I'm in a little kind of window of movement. For example, running is probably the most dangerous sport on the planet. And the injury statistics in running are shameful, that 80% of runners will be, you know, injured in a year. And I think in America, there are only like 30 million runners or something like that. And so, I mean, if you knew that 8 out of 10 children get injured running, would you say, go ahead and run? No, you'd be the most, you know, a terrible, notorious parent to put your kids in something that dangerous. And the problem is running, you know, I can do it for a long time until I end up having a problem. And then you'll go see a physio or a physician, and it turns out, you know, you may not have had full range of motion in your ankles. Your quads may have just been very stiff. You may not actually been able to open up your hip because, you know, you have a job that forces you to sit because you have a great brain, and that's where most of this has been kind of come about. So It's difficult to see these things during running. It's more easy to see these things when we start to establish what we think are just movement minimums, basic competencies for humans. And so suddenly those sort of red flags or those incomplete ranges or motor control pieces, you know, those things become very, very clear to anyone. The model for this, I think, is even, you know, in our own personal experience. Do you remember in middle school, your gym teacher screened you for scoliosis? Do you remember that horrible, awkward thing? Well, if that gym teacher, who was probably not very sophisticated in spinal mechanics, could identify a big deflection in your spine, you know, when you see your child get up from the ground and her knees touch, that's a red flag. If you're standing and your feet are turned out like ducks and your ankles are completely collapsed, that's a poor position. And so I think what we want to do is start saying, here are our movement minimums. Can you achieve this? And then try to really make this a democratized system so that we can then spin that up into a movement practice where we can say, are you competent enough at these kind of elemental human positions that we think that you at least have the range of motion and the tissue health to go and, you know, explore these other things. Strength and conditioning are aside. And traditionally what we've told people is, hey, just go get stronger and just go get, you know, go get fitter. And what we've done is just kind of, you know, we just put a bigger engine into the bent frame with the wheels on the car that doesn't work. And, you know, we've just really kind of gone about this the wrong way. If we give people a movement practice, and that's why, you know, I was just lecturing at the Stanford Medical School, to all those physicians. And a physician, this is their own statistics at Stanford, a physician, their typical workload, they'll see 50% musculoskeletal problems. So people will come in with some kind of nonspecific low back pain or shoulder impingement or foot pain or something like that. You know, and in that little time, you know, how are we going to address that? Well, if the physician just started taking a crack at the mechanics, you know, do they know what to look for? Hey, your quads or your calves are very, very, very tight and stiff, and your ankles aren't really working like ankles. They're working like ice blocks. Then that's an easy way to just immediately feed slack to a system. And people can relate. If you had a hinge in an old house, there's usually a pile of hinge dust at the bottom of the hinge. And I think the body is very similar. And if we can just feed slack enough, then we can at least have enough competence and breathing room to then go ahead and learn the skill. And it's okay to put technique and skill back into human movement.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Lisa is with us in Park City. Lisa, hi.
Hi. So I am a massage therapist here in Park City and in Salt Lake City. And I've practiced for 10 years, and about 4 years into it, I realized the work I was doing was really temporary. It was not addressing this chronic tension that people hold in their body. So I started studying a therapy called push therapy. It was developed by a gentleman in the Sacramento Valley named Michael, where we treat the muscle cross-fiberly, so it brings attention to the muscle as to why it's holding chronic tension, so that we can release that tension, and then we address what you do in on a daily basis, how we sit, how we stand, how we don't stack our joints.
Fantastic.
As we're moving. And so I'm wondering if you've done any research with push therapy and if you've ever heard of it.
Well, I haven't heard of push therapy, but, you know, we like to say there's nothing new under the sun. Mm. You know, people have been walking on each other for a long time and addressing the stiffness. What's happened, I think, is, you know, it was Lisa's experience is that, you know, she was pushing the, you know, the task of Sisyphus, you know, the rock up the hill. Mm-hmm. People would show up and say, fix me, I'm ready. And, you know, she would crank on them for an hour and do her best work and they'd feel great. And then they wouldn't change any aspects of their lifestyle that sort of led them to, you know, which is movement quality, movement efficiency, and, you know, even self-care. Imagine just, you know, I'm never going to floss my teeth or brush, and just every, you know, once a week I'll show up, or once every 2 weeks I'll show up and see my dentist and say, clean me up. And that's literally what people were doing for Lisa. Lisa finds a better, sounds like you found a better solution, which is, hey, we need to work on a little bit more integrated system where we're just addressing some of the stiffness and then teaching people how to manage some of their habitus, their positions. And that really does start to resolve some of those problems. And as a therapist, that's the whole point. You know, at some point we thought we could do this ourselves. At what point do we stop needing teachers? And you should have a long-term relationship with your physio and a massage therapist and a dentist. And, you know, that's what we want for the lifetime.
Thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Kim is with us in Sandy. Kim, welcome.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Quickly, I'm 58 years old and have just embarked on my dream career, my third one, in nursing. But pain is preventing me from getting the enjoyment that I wanted. I've tried so many different things, Pilates, yoga, etc., and now I'm having to resort to pain medication. And I'm about ready to give up, and I just wondered if you would have any advice for how I can try again.
So, I mean, it's hard to diagnose particular sorts of things, but generally, what do you say, Kelly Sterrett, to her?
Well, you know, if we have unrelenting pain, something that's going on, that's, you know, isn't relent, you know, hasn't stopped, we definitely go see a physician. You know, we have a set of tools. We say night sweats, dizziness, fever, vomiting, nausea, unaccounted for weight loss or weight gain, changes in your bladder or bowel function. Those are pathology and are serious issues, and that's what our Western medical system is set up for. The other side is we really are just starting to understand what a lot of the mechanisms for driving this pain, and it sounds like she's taken a good crack at, you know, a movement practice. But imagine that even if I'm moving correctly, if my tissues are stiff, if, you know, I have fibrotic musculature, you know, whatever the mechanism is, if I'm not also addressing the biomechanics, then I end up missing a big piece of the puzzle. And so, you know, there was a recent study that came out that looked at a nonspecific low back pain. What they did was they injected the fascia, the connective tissue in the low back, which is just that big sheet of connective tissue that just wraps around your trunk like a belt. And they, just injecting the connective tissue, they were able to reproduce people's nonspecific low back pain that we've traditionally sort of centralized around the joint itself. The problem is that we're not taking a systems approach in our thinking. You know, we need to make sure that we know how to actually stabilize our spines. Well, that's what Pilates is really, really good at. Yoga is pretty good at that stuff. Then the other part of that then is that I have to be able to start to manage that. I would recommend that you look for our friend Jill Miller at Yoga Tune-Up. She has a real great therapeutic system of taking these little bit soft, spongy balls and imagine starting to address the quality of the tissues, the trigger points in there, how the sliding surfaces, how the different layers of skin and muscle and connective tissue relate. And at the very least, what we should be doing is thinking, what are the things in my toolkit that are very inexpensive that I can start to practice? One of our hypotheses is that, look, we want you to spend 10 to 15 minutes a day actually taking care of your tissues with a ball, with a tennis ball, with a one of these yoga tune-up balls, with a lacrosse ball, and then we can start to see what it's not. And most of our experience is that we're able to make significant changes in tissue quality and how these things relate, and that makes a big difference on the other end of chronic pain.
So take care of your soft tissues is one of those things.
Yeah, and that maybe one of the missing things. And that doesn't mean a massage therapist. Remember, they're expensive, right? You should have an expert who can really crack the rust off. You know, most of us can solve very common problems around our house, and then we get over our heads, we get some help. And that's what our, you know, allied healthcare and physio should be. I'm just over my head here. But little maintenance things, checking your oil, making sure that, you know, you've turned the tap off, those are within our scope of care, of taking care of ourselves. And you can brush your teeth and floss. I mean, flossing is very, very, very technical, and sometimes you make yourself bleed. I mean, that seems very, very scary, but it's become habituated and part of our model. If we give people this other saying or the other system of saying, hey, look, 10 or 15 minutes a day of working on your tissue qualities and positions, then what we start to see that there is a tide change in how the body regulates. Sometimes, for example, you know, people can relate right now that I'm sitting in a booth, and I'm a big guy. I'm about 230 pounds, and that means I have about 115 pounds of pressure on each one of my hamstrings and each one of my glutes. It's warm in here, and if I sit here for long periods of time, those tissues really start to adhere. If I'm not drinking enough water and eating a diet that's really inflamed, you know, I'm spiking my blood sugar all the time with soda and candy, and then all of a sudden I'm under massive amounts of stress, well, the tissues sort of relate that and tell that story. So we have to take a systems approach. Do I know how to breathe? That's really remarkable. When we have people start to roll around on their diaphragm on just a soft kid's ball, like one of those kid's balls that you get at, you know, the Walgreens, you know, one of those little princess kids. If we just have you roll around on that, it's shocking how tacked down people are and how stiff their viscera are, combined with trying to manage stress, get enough sleep, get enough water, and then take care of the tissues. We really see that the human has immense capacity to change. I can't speak to her individual situation, but I can say there's still probably things that she hasn't done yet.
Yeah. And we should point out, working on your tissue, that doesn't mean stretching. You're not entirely convinced stretching, at least stretching the way most of us stretch, is really all that helpful.
Probably not. And here's an easy way to understand this. Have you ever tried to stretch beef jerky?
No,
have to chew it up and break it up. Well, a lot of the body systems are like that. And just pulling on a system for us is like trying to jumpstart a car without the key in the ignition. And I think, you know, the issue for what we've traditionally thought about with stretching was that we were looking at the muscles. The muscles must be tight. And the muscles are a neuromuscular system. They don't work unless there's input from the brain. And so we have some different techniques of being able to sort of get your brain involved. But we actually hold stretching, you know, these static end ranges, something that looks like the splits. Yeah. It's sort of our lowest tier of how we try to affect the quality of human tissue, right? And I'll tell you, you know, if I keep saying that, but just so people understand, if you laid down on the ground and one of your friends or loved ones put their foot just on your quads, right on the front of your leg there, if they put any pressure on that and it hurts, it's not normal. And that's one of the ways that we can find out ourselves if our tissues or our bodies are normal. If I sat on a baseball or a lacrosse ball or a tennis ball or a pink spongy ball and it generates any pain locally around the ball, then that tissue is disnormal. It's atypical. Mm. It's completely normal tissue to be able to stand compression without pain. And you know this for yourself because you sit on a chair all the time. It doesn't hurt. But if I had you sit or push one of those balls into your low back or on your quads or in your chest, it's excruciating. So one of the ways that we can help people understand is that normal tissue, normal body parts aren't stiff like beef jerky and they're not painful. Mm. One of the ways that we can help people understand if they're working appropriately is that you should always be able to breathe while you're working on this. So if you put a ball, you grab a rolling pin and put your calves on it.
Yeah.
And if it takes your breath away, you're going too deep.
Right. 801-585-WEST, the number two. Join us back to the phones. Keith has been waiting. He's in Salt Lake. Keith, hi.
How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Okay, to the point. I'm 61 years old. I went from basically a sitting job for probably 12 years consecutively. And then now I have a movement job. At 61 years old, I discovered the therapist was saying, mechanics of movement, thinking ambidextrous. You mentioned the kindergartner that spontaneously runs to the bar. My mantra has been for years, pain is weakness going away. What part of the mental aspect? I find myself not stiff, in the morning, blah, blah, after long nights with work, but however, I don't have the symptoms that someone at my age that I've heard, I've worked around, have. I've seen so many younger people, and you say mechanics, posture, yeah. But what about the mental mindset? I'll take your answer off the phone.
Stay with us a minute, because I have a question. I'm not sure what you mean by the... Are you saying that pain is... the pain is a sign that things are getting better?
If you address that with the types of mechanics or the type of attitude of moving and ambidextrously, is what I discovered. When I discovered, I started using both sides of my body, started using my legs, abdomen coordinated versus just bending over, not using your knees, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I've worked in the moving industry, but when I got pain, that was a sign of, okay, there was a weak spot somewhere along the line. Now, sure, something catastrophic, maybe you got some serious issues in the story. But eventually it went away and was stronger. The mental mindset, what part does that play? Like that kid, kindergartner, that runs to the bars, reckless abandon. They don't know what they don't know. They don't know that they're not supposed to be able to do that.
Yeah, Dr. Starr, what do you
think?
That's
my question.
Well, what I think is, we live with pain so much and we ignore it. And then we cover it up with amazing pain meds, which are miracle drugs for those of you in chronic pain. The resting state of the human condition is pain-free. And we can certainly use pain as a guide. If I'm pushing on a tissue and it hurts, if I relieve the pressure and it goes away, then that tells me something about the quality of the tissue or in that direction of healing. I've discovered something. But waiting for something, if you're sitting at your desk and your neck starts to hurt, boom, red flag. You should be thinking, wow, my body is giving me very clear symptoms and very clear indications that my body mechanics are not good, and that's great. We just saw a New York Times article that said that most people over the age of 55 are living with chronic pain. They think it's normal. And they don't even talk to their doctor about it, which is pretty amazing. And as a physical therapist, we laugh because every single person I've ever seen ever says they have the highest pain threshold ever. They're very different. And I think the problem is that humans are really good at sucking it up. You're really good at ignoring it right to the place where you break. And there are good stories of people watching their bones break and in competition and really being able to sort of disregard all of the pre-symptoms, the precursors of this. And what we want to do is try to get people to shift away from the set of lagging indicators, numbness and tingling, pain, swelling, loss of range of motion, loss of force production. All of a sudden your hand is weak. Wow, something's going on. I need to get to the bottom of that. Mm-hmm. And if we can develop a movement practice and a regular soft tissue practice where I'm taking care of my body every day, which is my human right and responsibility, then we can start having a real more kind of adult conversation.
Alex in Ogden is joining us. He's a physical therapist. That idea of figuring it out before the pain, Alex, is something you're thinking about?
Oh, absolutely. Again, thanks for taking my call. You know, as a physical therapist and athletic trainer in the community, I think this conversation is something that is long overdue. I can't tell you how often I see patients come in with shoulder pain, knee pain, just like as the caller's saying, and you ask them to do simple movement patterns, and they absolutely cannot do it. And the question is how long has it been that way before they actually had pain? One of the biggest challenges that I find is, you know, as an athletic trainer, even getting athletes to care about their movement. When you even get the sedentary lifestyle person who does the bare minimum, the challenges that I have found is getting them to actually care about their movement patterns as a source of their pain. Hmm. And I can take my
comment. Boy, you nailed it.
Your question off the air.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kelly.
So I think there are really two interesting kernels here. The first is, how do we get people to care? And, you know, one of the ways that we do this, you know, especially in the athletic population, is that we make it about performance. Because if the mechanics are more efficient, then we see improvements in wattage, in poundage. If I can't get into this position, then I'm going to see a compromised force production. When we're in better shapes, we can see all the metrics of human performance go up. I mean, it's very simple. If you're dehydrated, even just 2%, we see a decrease in your VO2, your aerobic capacity, in 5 or 10%. Just a little bit of dehydration, big drop off in aerobic performance. And so athletes start to make that connections because we're obsessed and a little bit egotistical. What usually happens, though, is that, you know, the physical therapist is in such a tenuous position because we're set up to just get people functional again. Hey, you can get up off the toilet, you can do your bra and brush your hair and go to work, great job, and you're out of pain. But that's still so far away from resolving sort of the innate problems. And that's why we really feel like there's got to be some shift back to coaching, you know, little league coaches, PE teachers, personal trainers. You know, people have to be in a coached or an environment where people are scrutinizing their movement or developing a yoga practice with a teacher, because that's the missing link. And otherwise, if you're in to see your physio, you know, the physio, we just bang our heads against the wall because we don't have enough time to realize that, hey, boy, you don't have any movement schema to be able to do any of these things, and I can do this one aspect and, you know, and help you resolve that one problem, but we can see the other 30 problems that you don't even know about yet just because we watched you walk in, sit down, pick up your shoes. You know, it's all right there. That's why if we can get movement standards or movement minimums that people understand, they can start to solve these problems themselves and start asking the right question.
Dr. Kelly Starrett is with us. His book is called Becoming a Supple Leopard, The Ultimate Guide to Resolving Pain, Preventing Injury, and Optimizing Athletic Performance. He's got a new book coming out this spring called Desk Bound, Sitting is the New Smoking. Thanks very much for your call. We will take more when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Kelly Starrett. We're talking about movement. He has a book called Becoming a Supple Leopard. He has a new book called Desk Bound, Sitting is the New Smoking. That's coming out this spring. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Gary is with us in Layton. Gary, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I have muscular dystrophy. And it severely limits my movement. But I also think that what you're talking about could be really important for helping me make the most out of my muscles as they slowly decompensate over time. I mean, they're going to, the prognosis for them is they're just going to waste away slowly over time, but I want to make the most of them, and I think what you're talking about could maybe help me make the most of them. So I just sort of wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
Well, you know, I'm sure you already have a sort of cadre of people helping you manage and guide what's the appropriate amount of resistance training. How do I get enough work in that I, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm not limited in the rest of my activities of daily living. So, you know, in complex situations, absolutely, we start to develop a team around this. But, you know, one of the things that happens is the body is so resilient and so clever that as you lose muscle force production capabilities, the body compensates in kind by creating stiffness in areas that need stiffness. And so the soft tissue becomes soft, becomes brittle, the connective tissue becomes brittle. And what feels like, hey, this is a normal process of this, those can themselves can be the very genesis of pain generation. And with some real simple, gentle tools, it's worth taking a crack at. And we don't know until you start to do it. And I'm not obviously advocating for someone to stick their elbow into your quads and go to town. But, you know, a really gentle ball, a softer kind of, you know, rolling around. You know, the issue is we don't know. What we do know is if this tissue is stiff and painful, then we can take a crack at that. And even getting your brain involved, you know, if anyone out there gets a just say a softball or a lacrosse ball and puts it, you know, in their glutes or in their hamstrings, kind of sitting on a bench, if you probably can't take your full weight on that. If you just contract into the ball and then release, that's a sort of neuromuscular trick to get your brain to relax that muscle kind of connective tissue interface, and we can start to see changes in the whole system.
Gary, thanks. 801-585 West, again, the number to join the conversation. So how much do you figure this would take us each day to sort of maintain, at least get started working on our tissue, say, for example, 15, 20 minutes? What do you have in mind?
Well, we think, you know, my doctoral work was on barriers to adherence. And what we found, what I found was that the more stipulations you put between someone and getting something done, the less likely it's going to get done. If people can develop a practice, and I literally have not met someone who doesn't have 10 minutes to take care of themselves. Right. I mean, we call false if you, you know, you're literally telling me you can watch TV and text message and be on Facebook, but you don't have 10 minutes to sort of take care of your tissues. We've found that that 10 to 15 minute window, you know, every day aggregates into significant time. That's 90 minutes a week, and then extrapolate that out. And over months and months and months, you really are starting to find some of your own personal kind of blind spots. And what's really nice about this is that you start to sort of develop a language about yourself. And as we even extrapolate that into our elderly, a lot of the proprioception, my body's ability to know where it is in space, is diminished. And just rolling around on a really soft, gentle ball is one of the ways to sort of wake up your body's innate proprioceptive, you know, mechanisms. And, you know, I think the bare minimum of people spent 10 to 15 minutes a day literally just exploring their bodies from toe to head, because you're responsible for the whole thing. There's been plenty of resources out there. Even on our site, we have about 700 free videos about little 2-3 minute ideas where you can start to take care of yourself, where, you know, just start somewhere, put a ball, and then we can become more sophisticated as your sophistication evolves. But if you don't have any language, it certainly seems overwhelming. The book was designed to be a Betty Crocker cookbook. You can read the theory or you can start from day one, but you should know how to do some really, really simple maintenance on yourself. That 10 to 15 minutes is what we think is minimum therapeutic effect, but it's enough to really get the ship pointed in a different direction over time.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about people wearing flip-flops?
Ooh. Well, I think it's a boon for podiatrists and physical therapists. the problem is, you know, hey, they're cute, and, you know, my kids want to wear them to the pool. The problem is that you clench your toes. You've created a really artificial mechanic. You know, when you walk, your big toe should point down. It should release. But if you're clenching your toe, it ends up being very, very stiff. And the other thing that happens is that you end up taking away your ankle range of motion because you're trying to hold the flip-flop on. Mm. And now we've created an artificially stiff ankle. A busy person will take 10,000 steps a day. Just do the math on walking in flip-flops, and all of a sudden, you're into the millions of steps very, very quickly, and that's millions of oscillations. With stiff tissues and bad positions, it's a recipe for disaster.
This is a point you made before, the idea that when you have a bad habit, because we're this adaptation machine, we're going to do it millions of times.
You know, I don't think people realize how many duty cycles are set up. You know, we regularly see that people don't even have a schema to bend over and keep their back flat. And all of a sudden, you know, they bend over one day and pick up the pillow and they herniate. And, you know, and they go talk to their doctor, physical therapist, you know, and she's like, what happened? And you say, you know, I just picked up this pillow. And the real question is, how heavy was that pillow? Well, what was really happening was millions of bends over, picking up my child out of the crib, getting the groceries, tying my shoes, and not really understanding some just basics about how to keep your spine straight. You know, we say you shouldn't lift with a rounded back, but what does that really mean? And can I extrapolate that into just the little small inane movements in my life? Yes.
All right, quick question. Proper push-up.
Oh, really easy to understand. When you do a push-up, there should be no change in your spinal position. Feet together, butt should be squeezed, forearm should be vertical. It's one of those throwaway movements where just like, ah. But what we see is that people have no function in that and can't even understand that they're making basic shoulder errors and spine errors that reflect themselves in almost every other thing that they do.
All right, let me ask you this finally. And you referenced this a little bit earlier. When you think about young people who are constantly distracted by screens, we're all constantly distracted by screens.
It's a reality.
It's a reality, and it must give you a sense of concern, certainly urgency for your work.
Well, we took on sitting because we saw that it was impacting our lead athletes, but then I have two daughters, and we started to see in earnest the impacts it was having in real time. If you sit for 8 hours a day and it crushes at your job, is it okay for your kid to sit in the first grade for 8 hours a day? No way. And if you look at this, the total time spent sitting, you know, the research is clear. If you exercise for an hour a day but sit at your desk, it's the equivalent of sitting and smoking. You have a sedentary lifestyle. You cannot do it. So the bottom line is we have to put ourselves in some better positions, and we can totally manage working at a keyboard or standing, but we just need to know how.
Dr. Kelly Starrett, his book is called Becoming a Supple Leopard, The Ultimate Guide to Resolving Pain, Preventing Injury, and Optimizing Athletic Performance. His new book coming out in the spring is called Desk Bound, Sitting is the New Smoking. He joined us from a studio in Sausalito. Kelly, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.